Happen with Reef Bum is sponsored by Champion Lighting and Supply, Polo Reef, and Fauna Marine.
Hey, what's happening, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Rapping with Reef Bum. I'm your host, Keith Berkelhammer. So today on the live stream, I welcome Todd Gardner to the show. What's going on there, Todd?
Hi, thanks for having me.
I'm very psyched to have you on there, Todd. We had some technical difficulties connecting via Skype, but we got all that worked out, so appreciate you hanging in there and joining us tonight. Just for those that don't know Todd, he is a professor of aquaculture at Carteret Community College in Morehead City, North Carolina, and an aquaculture specialist for Biota Inc., which specializes in sustainably cultured marine fishes and invertebrates for aquariums. His life and his career have been shaped by his passion for marine life, and he's written numerous scientific and popular articles about his research and experiences collecting, keeping, and culturing marine organisms. Todd's professional background includes work on a National Geographic documentary, commercial fish farming at SeaQuest Hatchery in Puerto Rico, and an 11-year term at the Long Island Aquarium, where he spent much of his time developing techniques for raising difficult marine fish larvae. To date, he has raised more than 50 species. In 2013, Todd received the prestigious Aquarius of the Year Award from the Marine Aquarium Society of North America, MASNA. In his spare time, Todd dives, photographs marine life, runs marathons, and plays the guitar. So before we start chatting with Todd, I want to take care of some business and thank the sponsors of this live stream. My sponsors are really important to me because they make the show possible with their support. Really appreciate that. It means a lot, since I want to continue to bring awesome guests to help foster a learning environment on the show. Champion Lighting and Supply is one sponsor. Besides being a place for hobbyists to purchase saltwater aquarium supplies online, Champion Lighting is also a wholesale distributor for many popular brands. If you own an aquarium store or an aquarium service company, contact Champion Lighting through their website at championlighting.com to set up a wholesale account. Polo Reef, make sure to check out Polo Reef's new YouTube video that drops tomorrow. In this Polo University episode, Andrew and Dr. Alex Howe look at Uronema, Black Ick, and Flukes in detail. Also look for their Friday video this week, a podcast with Bob Stark from ESV with some very interesting topics. Make sure to subscribe to their YouTube channel at Polar Reef for video drop notifications. And finally, Fauna Marine. I do use the Fauna Marine ICP Total Test Kit, which gives a quick, accurate, and easy overview of over 90 water values in reef aquariums, from macro elements to trace elements and pollutants. You get a complete overview with corresponding dosage and action recommendations. All right, with that all out of the way, Todd, for those that don't know what the Biota Group is, can you give us an overview of it and what you do for them?
Okay, well, the Biota Group has three of its own hatcheries, one in Palau, one in Hawaii, and the newest one in North Carolina. And I oversee the operation in North Carolina. A couple of my students and former students. And I'm kind of live under a rock here because I don't leave the area very often. And I'm not always in tune with what's happening out in the rest of the company, but I know that they produce a really impressive variety of marine fishes. Also, really proud to say that my former student from Carteret Community College, James Gorky, and his wife, Zip, are now working at Biota's Hawaii facility. James is managing the Hawaii facility. So we've got people from Carteret Community College spreading out and infiltrating the company. And they also have a distribution center in Fort Lauderdale where all of us from the three hatcheries send our fish and they get distributed from there. And there's a terrific team down there that takes in all these fish from us every week and keeps them happy and healthy and gets them back out. And they also take in fish from other facilities. You know, what's happening in the commercial marine aquaculture community is we're starting to kind of form a network where We help each other out in that. We will buy fish from other facilities to redistribute them here if they don't have the means to, you know, distribute them easily within the United States. So some of our fish come from Bali Aquarich, and we sell some fish from Poma Labs and from other places. And we even have now some hobbyists that are just really into breeding at home and don't have the means or the desire to jump into the sales and marketing and distribution, and they just want to breed fish, which is kind of how I got involved. Right? I wanted to breed fish, but I didn't want to try and get bulk shipping discounts from UPS, and I didn't want to have to deal with individual customers. I just wanted to grow a lot of fish and send them somewhere, and so that's kind of how I fell in with Biota. And it just, they wanted more fish than I could grow in my fish room. So we kind of expanded into the college and started renting space from the college. So our Biota's relationship with Carteret Community College is very much like the relationship with Hawaii Pacific University and their aquaculture facility, the Oceanic Institute. Just we're on a much smaller scale here in North Carolina.
Before we continue, I want to thank Polo1126 for the super chat. The comment has been looking forward to this. Saw Todd at MACNA and have rewatched the talk so many times while learning to culture my phyto. Right, phytoplankton. Yes, that is something that I did for a little while. It's a lot of work, isn't it, Todd?
Can be. You might say it's the hardest part of the whole game. No, I don't know if it really is, but it's very challenging, and it's something that is completely unforgiving of taking a vacation or a day off or anything. You have to just be on it nonstop, and
it's about not contaminating the culture, right? I mean, that's a big thing.
Yes, and staying on a very strict schedule of making new cultures. If you let them go too long, you're going to lose them. So you have to be throwing phytoplankton away in order to maintain your cultures if you're growing more than you need at the moment. But we need it all the time.
Yeah. So all right, getting back to Biota. So you mentioned there is some crossover with the college, right, in terms of what you're doing with Biota?
Well, yes, in that we take on, Biota takes on one or two of our current students as interns.
Cool.
In our North Carolina operations every semester. And so far, everyone that we've hired to work at the facility have been students or former students of the college. And in some ways it takes some pressure off of our program to always have all the different components of an aquaculture operation going. So in a lot of schools and what used to happen at Carteret was that, you know, it would be winter break or summer break and everyone would go home and everything would shut down and then school would start and classes would start and we'd have to start up algae cultures and start up rotifer cultures and get fish spawning. And sometimes that can take years to get it all synced together so that you can have eggs produced and larvae, you know, good healthy larvae hatching and all the phytoplankton and zooplankton you need to raise them. And if you cut down to a skeleton crew even and just do light feeds and light maintenance on your broodstock, they're going to stop spawning. Mm. And if you let your phytoplankton cultures go without, you know, constant daily maintenance, they're going to crash. And so it just, the school calendar doesn't lend itself well to demonstrating real world aquaculture unless you have some way of keeping it going all the time. And, you know, and it's not a huge program. It's not bringing in the kind of money where the school can afford to have an entire staff running the facility 365 days a year. So it would, you know, we just kind of floundered along. But now there's every day of the year, there are eggs and there are larvae and there's phytoplankton and there's zooplankton, and students that are taking our classes can come in and see it or jump in and help. We, some of our laboratory sections of some of our classes involve just getting in and helping out with some of the biota systems. So, you know, if they need to demonstrate, you know, how to induce spawning in urchins, we say, all right, you know, the person teaching that class will ask us, all right, when are you going to be ready to spawn urchins? We'll plan our lab for that day. And then, you know, so yeah, it's a tremendous amount of crossover.
That's pretty cool. I mean, that's a lot of great hands-on experience for the students, the interns that are doing that. So that's pretty amazing. I mean, what is, like, and you mentioned, you know, spawning and hatching eggs and phytocultures. What is, like, you know, a day-to-day, typical day-to-day type of thing like for you and your employees and the interns there? Or is there not, like, a typical thing that goes on day in and day out?
Yeah, well, we have a very small staff, and so it kind of depends on whether it's one person running the whole show by themselves that day, or whether there's two or three people on. We try to, Monday is our busiest day because that's the day we ship fish out. So we try to make sure everyone's there on Monday. You know, a typical day involves, you know, just A, keeping your eyes on everything all the time, and getting your eyes on every single tank first thing as soon as you come in the morning and make sure everything's flowing properly, every pump is running, no filter socks are overflowing, that all the fish are happy and healthy, that there's proper food density in all the larval tanks. And then you come in and you do a once over, and then you have to make a mental checklist of which fires do I have to put out first, or can I get to just feeding, which is rare. but then it's really feeding and cleaning, and it can become routine, just like working in an aquarium or a zoo, which is so exciting at the beginning, or when you're an intern, or when you visit a zoo and dream about working there and being with these animals that you love so much. If you let it, it can quickly become routine and boring, because there's a lot, it all boils down to a lot of monotonous tasks. It doesn't matter, you know, whether you're working with dolphins or zebras or dogs. You know, you're cleaning up poop and you're feeding things. You become a slave to these animals. And so it can be a challenge to keep that initial enchantment that you feel for it when you start. And the people that make it in this line of work are people that manage to do that and don't let themselves get bored with it. But yeah, a typical day is mostly siphoning the bottoms of tanks and feeding fish.
Siphoning detritus out, just trying to make sure there's no excess waste nutrients in the systems.
Yeah, I mean, and obviously some kinds of systems don't need daily siphoning. They need their regular water changes, but a larval tank, you can't have powerful filters on a larval tank. So there's, you know, you're putting phytoplankton in and the fish are pooping and there's stuff building up on the bottom fast, and that can grow bacteria fast. So that has to get siphoned out every day. And you can't use a big siphon. You know, you're using a tiny little airline tubing, and it can take you 20 minutes to siphon one small tank.
Oh,
and
wow.
There's a lot of them. So
that can be monotonous.
Yeah.
How many gallons do you guys have in North Carolina in terms of different, you know, all the systems together, would you say?
I was told there'd be no math. I should know that. And offhand,
how many
I don't.
Different tanks, or I mean, that might be a hard number too to figure out. And
it's hard. And we're always adding new tanks. We're always looking around, saying, where can we squeeze another tank in here without our rent going up? So we got an initial allotment of space where we could put all our tanks. And then we started sneaking in more and more and more tanks and took over a whole other room. And finally, you know, someone at the college said, you know, we're going to have to raise your rent soon. You're taking up about twice the space you started with.
So being in Hurricane Alley there, have you guys had any, you know, issues with storms knocking out power for a while? I mean, I'm assuming you guys have backup generators.
We do. And we're lucky enough at the college facility to have most of our important life support systems are connected to the emergency power, and it has one of those automatic switchovers. So if the power goes out, it jumps right over. But it's still a nightmare because certain non-emergency things, like a lot of lights, aren't on there.
Yeah.
And then we have you know, lots of pumps. If there's a power interruption, they don't come right back on. They get stuck.
Yeah.
And then they get hot, and then they burn, and then they ruin. So,
yeah.
So if there are any power interruption, someone really needs to get in there right away and make sure everything's running again.
So I want to get to you. You mentioned shipping. You know, that, first of all, that's got to be a very gratifying point when you guys ship. I'm assuming, because that basically means that you've raised you know, the livestock to the point where it gets you know, shipped out to wholesale distributors or local fish stores or whoever your distribution network is. So that's got to be a very gratifying thing. I'm curious though, in terms of the shipping part of it. I used to ship corals rather recently, and I got out of it just because of the increased cost of shipping and the increased I guess volatility in terms of stuff making it next day when it's supposed to be making it next day. Have you guys been running into any shipping concerns, or are things okay even despite some of the stuff that's going on in the industry?
We are very lucky in North Carolina that we're so close to our hub in Florida, because even though we're not near any major airports, we rarely have a problem. Our stuff is there, you know, by noon the next day. And so everything else from the other facilities coming in from Hawaii and Palau, it's a much, much longer
yeah.
trip and much more stressful on the fish. So we're lucky in that, in this very short distance. I mean, if it came down to it, we haven't had to do this, but if it came down to it, someone could just drive a shipment down there. It would probably still be worth it, but nobody has time to do that.
Yeah, that sounds expensive too. Polo 1126, back to Phyto. Todd, do you have any recommendations for resources for information regarding Phyto culturing? Looking for more information regarding ratios, volumes of starter fertilizer, for example. Any good resources in terms of some good how-tos in Phyto culturing?
Well, you know, probably, I mean, my book that I learned all my plankton culture from was called The Plankton Culture Manual by Hoff and Snell, put out by Florida Aquafarms years ago. I still have it. But we've also come a long way since then. And these days, you know, I don't know. I mean, you can find a YouTube video on anything that can teach you faster than
I did a YouTube video on it. yeah.
But I mean, I think that's a good book, Frank Hoff's book. But I think the most important thing in doing it, you know, it's like baking bread. If you only do it once every few months, you're not going to get very good at it. You kind of have to do it over and over again and get into a routine where you really just know it. And it's the same thing with phytoplankton. And if it's one of these things you try to ramp up each time you get some larvae, it's going to be a disaster.
Yeah.
You have to get into a mindset of, I'm growing this every day for the rest of my life.
That's why I stopped.
I have to put time in every single weekend sterilizing flasks here in my kitchen, and they have to do it every week at the college. And if I don't do it, it's going to go down. It just has to be one of those non-negotiable things that you do without fail. And it's, you know, and it's the same with all the rest of aquaculture too. It's it can't be something that you just take a stab at when something spawns. It has to just be something you do all the time.
Yeah, you know, I just with culturing phyto, I might have just mentioned this before, but it's all about not contaminating the cultures. That's the big thing. That's like all the work that's involved is like using hydrogen peroxide, for instance, to clean the culture vessels and making sure that you're not they're not contaminated, dirty, or whatever. There's any possible, you know, other kind of bacteria that can get in there to impact the culture. I guess it doesn't take much.
No, there's a lot of, we could spend the whole entire time just talking about phytoplankton, and it's something that I spend a lot of time on in my courses. And even, you know, you can sit through hours and hours of these lectures and go through the lab portions and still not get it right if you're not absolutely consistent. And you know, just like with keeping fish, it doesn't matter how good your biosecurity is. It doesn't matter how much effort you put into not letting diseases get into your tank. You know that your fish can still get sick, even if you don't let anything in, because there's stuff there. Like, you know, when they're under stress, when they don't get treated properly, they're going to get sick anyway. And it's the same with your algae. It doesn't matter how sterile your technique is. If you don't make new cultures at the right time, they're going to crash. And part of that is that some species, like our most important phytoplankton, Isochrysis, doesn't exist as what they call an azenic culture. There's no such thing as a completely pure Isochrysis culture that is guaranteed to have no contamination in it. It's going to be bacterial, but it hasn't been fully isolated. So you get a new culture, and if you let your primary cultures sit for 3 weeks instead of 1 week before splitting them and making new cultures, that those other microbes in there are going to start to gain some ground. And again, no matter how good you are at keeping contamination out, the cells are living and growing and dying in there. So you have an increasing mass of dead algae cells in your cultures, even if you've never let any contaminants in.
Is the Isochrysis the phyto that hobbyists should be targeting in terms of trying to raise in culture? Is that the most, is that the easiest and a beneficial phyto to feed a tank if you're looking to increase coral health?
Well, I don't mind telling you, I'm not a coral guy, and I don't know how much phytoplankton corals eat. I look at the size of their mouths and think, do they really care about phytoplankton? But I think they do take some in. I think if I was only going to culture one species of phytoplankton, which I don't, we culture a few, but if I was only going to culture one, it would be Isochrysis. And I have no idea what corals prefer, but I can tell you that the nutritional profile of Isochrysis for marine fish larvae is better than any other single species that you can buy in culture. And I would think that, you know, the nutritional demands of corals might not be all that different. But I don't know what they want.
You know, one thing I observed when I was doing the phyto culturing and feeding my tanks is that I noticed an increase in my pod population. I've heard other folks say that as well, that they've observed that. Is that something that is scientifically proven? Do you know, or is that just something that is more like an anecdotal thing?
Well, as far as what actually happens in reef tanks, you know, who's to say? They're complex systems. But as far as what copepods eat, well, most of the copepods that we like eat almost exclusively phytoplankton. So obviously, your tank can support more copepods when you add phytoplankton. And maybe that's what the corals are really benefiting from, the feeding on copepods at night when their polyps extend to, that are being encouraged by the phytoplankton additions.
Switching gears a little bit here, I see a question from Chris at ACI Aquaculture. What's happening, Chris? Question is, I heard Todd might have baby urchins available. Is that true?
You can pass
on that question if you want.
Well, we do. We raise urchins. We raise tuxedo urchins and our local purple urchins. And I don't know when we send them, if they have enough to, put on the big list or whether they go through retail or wholesale or what, but we do raise urchins and we send some every week to Florida. We wish we could raise, 1,000 times as many, but they're very slow growing and they really do best in a larger tank. They don't do well in our normal, smaller size larval tanks. And we don't have space for a lot of big tanks. So we have a handful of, tanks that are up around 90 gallon larval tanks. And if we devote one of them to a batch of urchins, they're going to be in there for 3 months. I mean, they only take about 1 month to settle out, but they're going to take up that whole tank for 3 months before they're big enough for us to move them out.
Gotcha. So in terms of tuxedo urchins, they're good in terms of great herbivores, right? They'll go after hair algae. What other kind of algaes will they munch on?
They'll munch on most macroalgae. So if you're trying to grow lots of macroalgae, you don't want to put a pile of these in, but they can be good at keeping it cropped. And not letting it get out of hand. We can't even, grow enough of the hair algae that they like to feed. When we've got 1,000 tuxedo urchins, we're grabbing seaweed from outside to feed them.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, they move fast then, I guess, is what you're saying there. Because I guess I don't think I've ever had any urchins in any of my reef tanks, but I've been thinking about it, intrigued because they are such great herbivores. My only hesitation is that they can mow over corals, especially if you have a frag tank full of some frags. I'd imagine that could be quite the scene there in terms of them pushing stuff over.
Yeah, well, if your frags, I think with tuxedo urchins, they move pretty daintily. They're not like big bulldozers. They're not like a big Mexican turbo snail, but they do pick things up. And if your frags aren't secured, they'll end up carrying a bunch of frags around on their back. Isn't that what they make glue for? Secure your frags and don't worry about it. They're not going to eat your corals.
Yeah. Now I've heard that they could carry stuff around.
And there is some concern like with really tiny little new, sexually produced corals where they're just a couple of polyps that they could accidentally eat them. And we actually sent some baby urchins to Richard Ross for his coral lab a couple of months ago. Just right after they settled. I mean, they were like smaller than pinheads.
Wow.
Just little dots.
Wow.
And we sent them out there. So part of it is just having them sized right. If you have a lot of small frags and you want to give them time to settle in and get themselves attached, you can put much smaller urchins in.
Gotcha. Yeah. No, that's an interesting idea. Polar Reef by Andrew Sander. What's up? Happening there, Andrew? It wants to ask you if the blends sold in bottles are truly blends once we get them with one strain like Nano chowing the others.
I wouldn't use a blend. Like you're talking about a phytoplankton blend.
I think that's what he's talking about.
Yeah. I wouldn't use a blend to start a phytoplankton culture. because you just can't grow to, you know, one will overtake the other for sure. But if they're being refrigerated and then just put into the tank, or you know, you can, I think they make blends really to try and give a little bit of a better nutrient profile, you know, try and hit more of the nutritional marks by adding, you know, one that's high in one fatty acid and one that's high in another fatty acid, and get a more well-rounded diet. We find with feeding the urchins, we really need to feed them a blend, and you know, we can't grow the urchins if we just use isochrysis, but we can, you know, with lots of other things.
If the urchins go through and take care of all your algae, and sounds like they can do that pretty easily. Do you need to feed them something else in terms of keeping them you know, satisfied, or are there other things in the tank like detritus that they'll you know, consume?
I think they, you know, I don't think they're really detrital feeders. I think that, you know, you probably want to get the right number of them for your tank, that, you know, where a balance will be struck between algae growth and the urchins continually feeding. I can't speak from experience because, I just grow tanks full of urchins, or what we do, my guys do. My guy Ben does most of the Ben and Peyton do all the urchin growing at our facility. But we just have these tanks full of urchins, and we send them out. So we each of us has our own little mini reef tank at home, but it's small. Mine's just a 20-gallon tank.
Well, you got plenty of tanks at the facility, I'm assuming there, so.
Yeah, and plenty here, too. Yeah. But you have to have something that's just for fun. They can't all be work tanks.
Vinny from Vin's Fins reminds us that urchins like to eat coralline algae, so that's, I've read that as well. Yeah.
Yeah, they will scrape it, and almost any urchin. We have a fiberglass tank that we put some of our purple urchins in, and you can see where they leave little trails through the algae. And if you look really close, you know, they're digging into the fiberglass too.
what's the difference between the purple urchins and the tuxedo urchins in terms of like the best, you know, cases to use them?
I cannot answer that from any experience. We just took on the purple urchin because it's a local species, and we like to, whenever we can, grow some local things because it's, you know, it just kind of is a nice story in our local community. Yeah. To say these are fish, or these are animals from Eastern North Carolina. And they're also easy to obtain without shipping them in and worrying about, you know, escapees, you know, getting out into the bay and stuff. Mm. So we can go out and literally take purple urchins right off, you know, some of the rock right on Bogue Sound where we're located, and spawn them and then release them again. And it, you know, they mow through algae also. They're a little bit different. You know, they have kind of longer, sharper spines than the tuxedos. We're playing around with them, putting them in some of our Bangai cardinals and seeing how they sidle up to them. You know, they're not quite a diadema urchin, but they do have a little bit longer spines, and the cardinals seem to like them.
Gotcha. All right, we got a fish question here from Brent Jones, fellow North Carolina native here. What species of fish does Todd grow out in North Carolina? I've been interested in biota court jester, which facility of those are? I guess the question is biota court jester, which facility are those coming out of? Fish, Todd, in terms of coming out of North Carolina.
Okay. So the court jester, I'm pretty sure, is done at the Palau facility. And so North Carolina is doing the Royal Grammas, the Gramma de Jongi, Neon Gobies, the flathead perch, lawnmower blennies, not lawnmower, you know what I mean, Molly Miller blennies. So we're really mostly we're doing Atlantic species. The flathead perch is not Atlantic. We are taking up Bengay cardinals. They're not into production yet, but we want to we want to get them going here. It's a good one for our students to work with. And we do peppermint shrimp, and we do the Bergia verrucicornis, the aphthasia eating nudibranch. And what else? The two urchins. I guess that's about it right now. Got a couple of other possible things coming down the pike. But they're probably 90% of what we do are Atlantic Caribbean species, and several of them are from local waters or can be found in local waters.
Here's one that I'm probably going to mispronounce, but Aquatic Maniac is asking, would you ever consider starting up the Lipogramma coli breeding again? Would be awesome to see even more deep water species like that hit the market as captive bred.
I know that I would love to. My guys would love to. And, you know, it's funny that 25 years ago when I was bred Royal Grammas for my first time, I said, these aren't worth it. You know, these fish are $8 a piece and it's a pain in the neck to raise them. And it's only because of some of these more expensive Gramma species that it made it worthwhile re-examining how to raise them and forced me to get better at it, to the point where now it does make sense to raise Royal Grammas. Not only are they worth more now, of course, but also, you know, I've spent, you know, I don't know how many years chipping away at some of the fish in this family. And yeah, I got a hold of a couple of those Lipogramma clayi back about 10 or 15 years ago and raised a few, and it was very tedious. And now I would love to revisit that. Some of the other Lipogramma, too. Lipogramma evites is one of my fish that I'd most like to tackle.
If somebody can find a picture or a link to the to the Lipogramma clay, just put it in the chat, because I'm not familiar with that. I'd love to see what that looks like.
If you find the one that's on reefs.com, I wrote an article about raising them.
Cool.
The Forrest Young at Dynasty Marine, when I was working at the Long Island Aquarium, sent me some, and I raised a handful of them and sent them back to him. And so, as far as I know, that's the only time they were ever raised.
Wow.
I'd love to have a shot at it again. At first glance, the Lipogramma clayi doesn't really look any prettier than a Royal Gramma. It's just 500 times the price. it does have some subtle beauty, and it is more rare in deeper water. But there's some other of those basslets, some really cool bass and basslets that are a little deeper and harder to come by that I'd love to have a crack at again. Just like the Liapropoma. You know, back when I was messing around with candy bass and Swiss guard bass, it was kind of like the Royal Grammas. They were worth pretty good money, but so tedious and so long to reach metamorphosis. And now working with the flathead perch, that's very closely related, I've figured out a lot of the roadblocks in that, and not only figured out roadblocks, but realized that just because one time it takes 120 days to reach metamorphosis doesn't mean it's going to take that every time. This, you know, sometimes there are little subtle things during the development that can cause the larval period to last much longer. And so the first batch of flathead perch only took 40 days, but I've had them take 90 or 100 days to settle. And so I'm realizing maybe the 120 days it took the candy bass, maybe that's not it. Maybe they took too long, and maybe it could be done in less time.
Interesting. So
I'd love to revisit lots of those. Yeah.
John Wright's asking, I love the Molly Miller Blenny, but does Todd think they eat Aptasia? Are those Aptasia eaters?
We don't let them near our Aptasia because our Aptasia are too valuable to us for the purpose of producing Bergia. But the people that I know that have been keeping them long-term swear to me that they eat Aptasia.
And I guess another good fish would be Aptasia eating filefish, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And almost any filefish will eat Aptasia. The problem is some filefish will also eat everything else.
That's not a good thing. I had both Sanjay and Mike on, I think it was last week, and we were talking about Sanjay's got, I know, at least one orange spotted filefish that he has in his tank, and you know, he says that he doesn't have any polyp extension really during the daytime, but he doesn't care because he knows there's a lot of polyp extension when the lights are off. But he also says that I think he at one point had seen aquareeding flatworms in his tank, and maybe he also had red bugs, but he just doesn't see those things anymore. And I guess the question is whether the filefish, the orange spotted filefish, is the one that's taking care of that pest problem for them.
I wouldn't be surprised at all. That seems like the kind of thing they would go for. I know they're corallivores, but we know that they will eat other things. So
that's the whole trick, you know, especially with the aquareeding flatworms, is finding natural predators that will eat the eggs. You know, peppermint shrimp. I know Chris Meckley swears by peppermint shrimp on the west coast of Florida as a variety of peppermint shrimp that will eat aquareeding flatworm eggs. I know Andrew Sandler has brought in some very tiny variety of peppermint shrimp from Australia that, again, believes is eating the... I think they've proven that in their lab, that they've eaten the aquareeding flatworm eggs. It's, I guess the question is, when you put those peppermint shrimp into a captive reef with fish and a whole bunch of stuff going on there, will they behave like that in a captive reef tank? I don't know. I guess that's a question I wanted to ask you. You guys raise peppermint shrimp, right?
Yeah. And I've given a lot of thought to this because I've been keeping and breeding peppermint shrimp for, you know, probably close to 20 years, but, I think, you know, they're like so many other things, they're opportunistic. And I remember I had some, I, when I was at the Long Island Aquarium, I had this really cool tank. It was the filter feeder tank, we called it. It was all non-photosynthetic reef animals. So there, I mean, there were sponges in there that just grew on their own, but it was all, non-photosynthetic corals, gorgonians. And so I put a ton of food back then. You could get this product Cyclopes, which was just the best frozen copepod product ever. I've never found anything that
it came in
close.
like a bar, right?
Yeah, we got in these big flat packs, and I'd break off chunks and thaw them out in salt water. And there's some red Arctic copepods out there now, but they're not the same. And anyway, I never saw anything get these corals so excited as that Cyclopes, and also larval fish. Like, it was just the best thing to get a larval fish from eating live Artemia at that stage onto something frozen. And anyway, so I had to feed this tank a lot of plankton. I put in rotifers, and I put in Artemia, and I put in the Cyclopes every day. So there was no keeping Aptasia out of that system. It was the most Aptasia infested system I've ever seen, all through the pipes, everywhere. Wow. And so I would get in every, 6 months or so, I'd put in about 20 peppermint shrimp, and they'd mow them down pretty good for a while. But they eventually, as they grew, they got a little territorial and a little cannibalistic. And I always, after about 6 months, ended up with just two. It was only a 50-gallon tank. But the other problem was that after a few weeks of having this flurry of frozen plankton thrown in there every day. They just developed such a taste for that. They didn't care about the aptasia anymore. They'd come in, they'd be stealing the plankton right out of the... so I think if you have a tank that gets a tremendous amount of food, they're maybe not the best choice for aptasia control because they're going to be full all the time. They have to be a little bit hungry. And on the other end of that spectrum, if you have a tank that you don't feed anything, if they get really hungry and there's no aptasia to eat, they'll stray onto other things. I remember I had this beautiful little Posillipora that I was growing in a separate tank on one of my systems there. And I just got in a whole big shipment of peppermint shrimp. And I said, oh, I'm going to put them all in this tank. And I put about 50 peppermint shrimp in this 10-gallon tank with this piece of Posillipora. And I came back an hour later, and every bit of tissue was gone off the Posillipora. They were hungry, and there were a lot of them, and there was nothing else to eat. But what I like about our peppermint shrimp, and it's the same, it's Lismata wirtemanni. It's the one that ranges down into Florida and the Gulf of Mexico. But when I stick my head in the water around here, I see that we have pretty low coral diversity, but we have a lot of aptasia growing wild here. So you go out on a dock piling or a bulkhead in the intercoastal here, and the dominant cnidarian is aptasia. Huge. I mean, they're kind of beautiful when you see them growing wild and they're in a big mass, and they get, when they're exposed to sunlight, they get some color to them. But that is by far the most common benthic cnidarian growing in our coastal water. So when I started catching peppermint shrimp here, I said, well, these guys probably have a real taste for aptasia because it's they're, you know, the most common thing for them to eat. They don't have other corals to feed on, not in any big numbers. We have some oculina, and we have some sea whips growing inshore. So I went just at my local little boat ramp here and collected some peppermint shrimp, and we started breeding them. And when we sent them, our guys in Florida said, we're getting really good feedback on these peppermint shrimp from people, you know, that are using them for aptasia control. So that made me feel good and made me feel like maybe there's something to getting them from a place where mostly aptasia growing.
Right. What about aquareeding flatworm eggs and flatworms themselves? Have you had any insights in terms of whether or not they prey on that stuff, at least the ones that go through your facility?
No, I can't speak to that, you know, out of any experience. I can tell you it's all a little, probably a balancing act about being just the right amount of hungry. But you know, if I probably Jake at our Fort Lauderdale facility, who deals with all the incoming corals and things there, could shed a little better insight into that than I can. Like I said, I have one token 20-gallon reef tank in my fish room, and it's just one of my few tanks that's only for fun. And I'm flying blind. I'm not a reef guy. You know, I'm a fish guy.
Speaking of fish, we got another question from John Wright. Does Todd see any, and I don't know if you can answer this question, does Todd see any difference in terms of behavior between tank bred fish and ocean caught fish?
I would say that, you know, the thing that is most noticeable to me, and I remember seeing this back when we were bringing dotty backs into the captive bred world, you know, back 25 years ago, is that they definitely are less inclined to kill each other when you're trying to make pairs. As far as other behaviors, it's hard to say. I for all the time I spend with fish, I probably don't spend enough time just sitting and looking at them. but I can tell you that it is always easier to make a pair from captive bred fish than from wild caught fish. And part of it is because they've spent their whole life in close quarters with other members of their own species. And a lot of the things we like to breed are at least to some extent territorial. But when we first started trying to make Dottieback pairs back in the 90s, God, we brought in so many and watched them kill each other. But then just that next generation where you'd have, you know, a bunch of them raised in a tank together. And part of it is that part of what makes that pairing easier is that so many of these fish are hermaphrodites. So if you put any two together that are young enough, they'll grow into being a pair. So that's true with a lot of our gobies and with our grammas, and it's true with clownfish. It's true. I think it's true with Dottiebacks too. You just put two young enough ones in together, you can end up with a pair. But again, also they've been around each other already, so they're not going to feel threatened when they see another member of their own species.
Gotcha.
As far as other behaviors, I don't really know.
Can we get into a little bit in terms of the process that you guys go through there at Biota? You know, on the website, it says that Biota believes in a better way of doing things, you know. So can you kind of like get into, you know, how Biota does it versus other entities out there that raise captive bred fish? What's unique about the process that you guys use to raise captive bred fish?
Well, I don't think there's one universal technique throughout our company. You know, each of our hatcheries has its own separate staff and its own, you know, dedicated and experienced people that come from their own background. And each species, or at least each genus that we raise, requires a separate protocol, which is one of the biggest challenges about captive breeding of fish, is that especially aquarium fish, our hobby demands a huge variety, and you really need to specialize at a species to get good at it. So what works for raising royal grammas is completely different than what works for raising clownfish, and it's completely different than what works for raising gobies. And sometimes it's in terms of the shape of the tank or the density of the algae in the tank. So I can't really point to one thing that we do different that would span across all of our facilities. And like I said, I've only spent a few days ever at the Hawaii facility. I've never been to the Palau facility. I've only spent an hour at the Fort Lauderdale facility. So all I know is what we do in North Carolina. And I will say that I'm thankful that our upper management really, you know, gives us some great guidance and great direction, but also gives us the freedom to pull from our own experience to do things how we feel they need to be done where we are.
Gotcha. This is an interesting question from Jason Langer. Asked Todd if he's noticed an impact on the fish populations from the invasive lionfish in his region.
I feel like I'm not going to be able to answer that unless I get a lionfish cookie. FYI, speaking of Jason Langer, I'm just going to tilt up.
There you go.
Just slightly. See that?
Yeah.
As a place of honor. That's an original Jason Langer.
Is that a
Brahma Dijon?
Oh, nice. Mm-hmm. Awesome.
So anyway, have I noticed it? It's hard to say. I can tell you that once you get to a certain depth offshore here, there is really an alarming number of lionfish, and their bellies are completely full of little fish. And it's hard to say what populations they're impacting. You know, we know they're going to eat anything in the size range to fit in their mouths. But there are some unique things about the way lionfish are, or the way the lionfish populations are behaving in the Atlantic, that we don't see in their native range. And one of those is that they seem to be living and thriving into much deeper depths in the Atlantic than they do in most of their native range. And also, I don't know what their maximum size is normally, but we see a lot of really, really big ones. You know, I've shown some of the really big ones I've caught to people that, you know, live in the range of lionfish. They say, I've never seen a lionfish this big.
Parrot.
I can tell you that when I catch them, I always cut them open. And they eat so much and digest so fast. There's a lot of mush that's hard to discern. But I will tell you that usually what I see the most of are the species that I see the most of. So I don't know that they're targeting really special things like baby groupers and Spanish hogfish and the things we really want to try and save. What I see is that they have bellies full of the massive schooling fish. There's a fish called the Tom Tate grunt. That's our most common grunt we see. They just form schools of hundreds of millions. And that's probably the fish I see most frequently in lionfish stomachs. And then another fish called the scad, which is in the jack family, but it's shaped like a little anchovy. It's a small, slender fish. And everything is feeding on those scad. And the lionfish are full of those too.
Apparently lionfish are good eating.
They are terrific. Yes. I spent some time really thinking about how can I use this to promote eating more lionfish? And I made the Facebook post the other day and showed my lawn full of lionfish I just came back with. And then I spent a whole week eating lionfish and feeding them to everyone in my life. And everyone loved them. I mean, we were having them side by side with, you know, other expensive game fish that occur around here. And the lionfish was at least as well liked as anything else that we
had. I've never had one.
It's really good. But somebody actually semi-locally said, hey, can I buy some lionfish from you? And then someone else told me on, you know, someone commented on Facebook, you know, I looked into ordering some lionfish from somewhere in Florida and it was like $30 a pound. That's just ridiculous, you know? So I said, let me do some quick math. I did a dive trip last weekend. I spent $330 for the trip and I spent my entire day out there and I decided, once I saw how many lionfish, I was like, all right, I'm going to drop all my other goals for the day. And I'm just going to spend the day catching lionfish and a couple of lobsters, but mostly lionfish. So I caught 17 lionfish. I came back. I spent 3 hours cleaning them and filleting them and putting my stuff away and everything. You know, so I was until 9 p.m. I was up at 4:30 in the morning and I finished cleaning my stuff at 9 p.m. that night. And spent $330 on the dive trip. And then I weighed a couple of the fillets. Someone said, how much would it be for me to buy some of those fillets from you? So I weighed the fillets and they're about two fillets from an average sized lionfish for about 5.5 ounces. Some of them were much bigger, but the average. And I did a quick calculation and that came out to those lionfish fillets cost me $60 a pound.
Wow.
Without any labor figured in, without my time or anything else, just what I spent for the dive trip. I could have spent more time catching lionfish and less time catching lobsters, and I probably could get more efficient at it. And I could have really looked out for bigger ones, but it wouldn't have changed things that much. And the problem is that lionfish are not on the kind of bottom where you can say pull a trawl net. They're on a complex, rocky, rigid bottom or a shipwreck. Can't pull a net over it. And if you did, you'd be catching everything else. And on top of that, you know, there's a giant diversity of fish down there. So if you're fishing with rod and reel, you have a very, I don't know anyone who has ever caught a lionfish on a hook in North Carolina, and I have a lot of friends that put in a lot of time fishing. And they're not, you can't find them in 20 or 30 feet of water here like you can in some of the Caribbean islands. They're in 90 to 300 feet of water. So wow. That means you're going 30 miles out to get to the areas where you're going to find a lot of them and make it worthwhile. But now you're diving in, say, 110 feet of water. You've got 20 minutes bottom time. You're breathing nitrox, and you have an expensive trip and a lot of gas. And
adds up.
So there's not a simple way to make lionfish cheap unless you want to farm them, and no one wants to do that.
Just so everybody is on the same page, you're encouraged to kill lionfish, right? I mean, they're invasive species and
in the Atlantic. Yeah, they're not bad guys everywhere, but they are invasive in the Atlantic. They've been here since, you know, at least the late 90s. And they don't have no predators. There are things eating them and learning to eat them. Groupers will eat them in the right size range, and triggerfish will eat them. And I know their divers are trying to train sharks to eat them. They're spearing one and then waving it in front of a shark's mouth and trying to get them to eat it. But I had a friend on Long Island who caught a little baby snowy grouper and a little baby lionfish and put them in the tank together, and the snowy grouper swallowed the lionfish whole and was fine. So, and snowy grouper is from the Atlantic too.
So Sturgis Reef has this question, and I had the same kind of question. I didn't realize lionfish are that far up in North Carolina, but yeah, the question is, how far up do they reach currently? I mean, do they go all the way up the East Coast, or are they pretty much in the Gulf Stream? Is that where they're traveling, via the Gulf Stream?
So there's not a simple answer. And the fact is, you can catch a juvenile lionfish well up into New England.
Wow.
Lionfish, I have a special relationship with lionfish because in 2001, I found two tiny little baby lionfish while snorkeling on Long Island, New York. And at that time, there was no news out about invasive lionfish in the Atlantic. So I was just very confused. And I contacted some people, and somebody from NOAA contacted me right away and said, hey, we're just about to write a paper on, you know, some sightings of lionfish, occurrences of lionfish in the Carolinas and Florida over the last couple of years. And we can't believe this is the first time a baby one's ever been caught in the Atlantic. And can you send us one of those? And you want to be on our paper? And so I got on that very first paper documenting lionfish as an invasive species in the Atlantic, and then proceeded to, you know, keep looking for them and catching more over the next few years. And for me, it was really exciting at the time. But the thing is, once you get north of Cape Hatteras, the Gulf Stream veers out over very deep ocean water. So you can have lionfish, just like you can have queen angels and blue angels and French angels and tangs and all these other tropical species living year round on this very narrow band. Inshore, here in North Carolina, the water gets very cold. We get ice on the surface. Everything remotely tropical dies until you get about 15 or 20 miles out, where now the Gulf Stream is enough of a presence out there and running, and it's not so deep. The Gulf Stream is a surface current, but it runs pretty deep because it's so strong. And so it's kind of moving along the bottom from about 20 miles out to the edge of the continental shelf. And in that narrow band from, you know, North Florida on up to Cape Hatteras, there's year-round tropical communities, including now lionfish. So you're never going to find an adult lionfish on Long Island or in Cape Cod, but you will find little juveniles that come up as larvae and develop on their way up and then settle out, just like you can catch a French angelfish on Long Island. But you're never going to find an adult French angelfish on Long Island. Same with lion. Now, the farthest north a lionfish has been caught, now, last year or the year before, somebody caught a lionfish in off the coast of England.
Wow.
So they've now crossed the Atlantic in the North Atlantic Current, the extension of the Gulf Stream. Can they survive year round there? I don't know. I will tell you that I've seen them in water as cold as 50 degrees. Hmm. So if there's, you know, that island of Scilly off the coast of England that gets bathed in Gulf Stream water, does that water stay at least 50 degrees? If it does, lionfish could end up, you know, having a resident population there. Or they could swing around and end up in the Canary Islands. They're moving through the Mediterranean Sea too. They've moved through Terois Miles, has come through the Suez Canal and is moving through the Mediterranean Sea on the east side of the Mediterranean. And so you could argue that the lionfish were going to get here eventually. Yeah. Anyway. Wow.
That's a bit of a problem.
It is. Yeah. But this is what we do. We're messing with the planet in ways that lots of things weren't ready for.
John Wright raises another interesting topic here, question, you know, and this is about pricing of tank bred fish versus wild caught. The question is, does Todd ever see the day when tank bred fish can be economical and profitable? That's not to say that you guys aren't profitable there at Biota with the captive raised fish, but I guess, yeah, the perception is right now that it is more expensive to buy a captive bred fish versus a wild caught fish. But, you know, certainly the benefits are greater with the captive bred fish because you're not impacting the environment by raising those kind of fish. But talk to us, Todd, if you can, about the economics of it all.
Well, you know, I can talk about some broad strokes about the economics of it, of course. I can tell you that it's raising marine ornamental fish is not just like most types of aquaculture. It's not something that anyone goes into to get rich. It's something that you go into out of passion and hope that you can make it economically viable. And I think that, it's really exciting to be living in a time where there are multiple companies that are working very hard at that. Biota and ORA and Pro Aquatics and Sustainable Aquatics, all of them now have put decades into, and they've kept at it. And I can't say how much money any of these companies are making or losing, but I know that they are all absolutely dedicated to making this a viable thing. And the reality that it may become our only choice at some point. A lot of the island nations where our fish originate are starting to realize that they don't want to sell off their resources. You know, they've been tricked into selling off their resources for hundreds of years, and maybe they can do better for their own economies by using those resources in other ways, like through ecotourism, scuba diving, and that's not to say there can't be sustainable wild collection. I do think that as everyone gets better at captive breeding, that the prices will become more reasonable. But really, I don't think the prices are that unreasonable, especially when you consider it's been so long since I bought a wild caught fish that I've forgotten how frustrating it is. I do keep some wild caught fish because I catch some of my own, you know, if I scuba dive, and if I want to catch something myself, I think catching something that doesn't have to get shipped around the world, it means it's not going to have the typical stresses of being in the supply chain. And I like to keep things that are local to my area in my own tanks for fun. But aside from that, anything I get from anywhere else now is captive bred. But once in a while, we need to take on a new species, and that involves bringing them in from the wild. And it's really a strong reminder when I have to do that, when I have to get in some new fish that has to get shipped from halfway around the world because we're trying to build a brood stock. Mm. And I see how stressed they are when they come in and how much mortality there is in that process. You don't see it when you buy a fish from a pet store, but when you have these connections to say, all right, I'm going to import some fish, you know, directly from the Philippines or from Indonesia, you know, from the wild, and we're going to get them through the normal supply chain. We have our connections. They're going to come through LA and they're going to go to Fort Lauderdale, and then they're going to come to us. And we're getting these fish in from the wild and in bulk to try and build our own brood stock. And when I see how many of those fish come in dead and or, you know, break out and all kinds of infections within the first few days, I think this is the part that we don't see when we're buying fish from the pet store, because yeah, that mortality is occurring in other people's tanks. And so, and then I go into a pet store and I'm hypersensitive to it now. And I look and I'm like, I look around and I look at who's scratching and who has spots on them and who's got a cloudy eye. And I think, I don't want to buy anything from here when I look at, you know, but sometimes I have to, because I'm trying to build a brood stock. And I think, gosh, I don't miss the days of having everything I put in my tank come through that wild,
yeah,
caught supply chain. And I think that the difference in survivorship that you see when you get, you know, captive bred fish that are well handled along the way, between that and getting things through that wild supply chain, is so great that it really accounts for a lot of that difference in price. Because it's not only,
it's worth it.
You'd have to not only consider the likelihood of the fish that you buy from the wild dying, but the likelihood of it causing an outbreak in your tank and causing you to lose everything, and then be put in this position. All right, well, what can I treat my fish with that's not going to kill my corals?
Right, right. There's not a lot of in-tank kind of treatments for that. Obviously, the chances of a captive bred fish, you know, in terms of getting disease in your facility is going to be a lot less than what you were just talking about in terms of bringing a wild-caught fish. But so, what do you guys do in that sense to, like, mitigate any chance that there could be some sort of disease or infection that comes into the facility there? What kind of processes do you utilize to try to mitigate that stuff?
Well, when we're talking about bringing in something new, it is isolated far from our, not as far as I'd like, but far from our stock of things. We usually, like, if we get in a new batch of wild caught fish, if we're trying to build a brood stock, we'll put it into, you know, an isolated tank. And we'll usually give it a couple of days and see who's going to die from the immediate stress, and wait till they're settled in and feeding. I never medicate anything unless I see it eating first, because the medication just adds a new level of stress. But then, you know, we have our standard medications that we'll use for the common stuff. And I try not to go too heavy and treat for too many different things, but you know, I'm mostly concerned with the standard cryptocarian, amludinium, and monogenetic trematodes on fish that are prone to those. And I don't automatically treat for things like internal parasites or bacterial infections unless I see signs that is happening. And as far as, you know, can captive bred fish still, you know,
carry disease?
Carry, of course, right? You know, but part of, and that's why I think it's always important to quarantine anything, no matter where it's from. And I know one of the things that, you know, is I think that just like when in September, when all our kids go back to school, within a few days, people are sick, right? Because everyone is all of a sudden exposed to germs that they weren't exposed to before. Nobody went in sick, but people came out sick because they're breathing on each other. And I think anytime you put a new fish in your tank, there is a chance that something on either side, either a new fish or an existing fish, is going to be exposed to something they weren't exposed to before and get sick. How do you best mitigate that? By reducing stress. I think the biggest killer of aquarium fish is stress from aggression. And anytime you put, no matter how healthy all your fish are and your new fish are, when you add a new fish to the scene, there is going to be new stress introduced into the tank. And if you can prevent that stress, then you're going to go a long way toward toward preventing any new outbreak from happening.
Todd, this is interesting. You know, I was looking at your website in terms of acclimating biota fish, and it says not to drip acclimate the fish from the any biota facility, which I find interesting because that's something I thought that we should all do. Why should people not drip acclimate fish from biota?
Yeah, I think, well, I don't think you should drip acclimate fish from anywhere. I would never drip acclimate a fish. I abandoned that in the 80s.
Oh, well, there you go. That's how much I know.
I was drip acclimating in the 80s. I worked in a wholesale operation in Pennsylvania, and we drip acclimated everything. And gosh, a lot of fish died. And it's a really simple reason is that no matter how well you purge a fish before you ship it, and you should always purge a fish a little bit before you ship it. The bigger it is, the longer you should purge it. By purging, I mean, don't feed it for a couple of days before you ship it. And this, of course, is why, one of the reasons why fish in the normal supply chain come in such bad shape is that sometimes they've been in that supply chain for 2 weeks, and sometimes nobody feeds them along the way because they want to be ready to ship them on any given day.
That's terrible.
And if you're feeding, they're going to be putting out a lot of ammonia. But even if they're not eating, they're still producing ammonia because they're still, their metabolism is still running. Ammonia is still being produced no matter how well purged. So if it's a very small fish, I just don't feed it the same day I'm sending it. If it's a little bit bigger, we'll go the day before. If it's a, you know, if it's a good, we don't sell any big fish out of North Carolina. We do all small fish at our facility. But anyway, regardless of the purging, ammonia is being released in the bag. And they're using up the oxygen, they're giving off CO2. As they're giving off CO2, that's dropping the pH in the bag. So what's happening is the pH is going down as the ammonia is climbing, and as the pH goes down, it causes the ammonia to go from its molecular form, NH3, to its ionic form, NH4+. And the reason is because what is low pH? It's more hydrogen ions. So the more hydrogen ions are freed up in the water, the more hydrogen ions can stick to the ammonia and form NH4+. And the thing is, NH4+ is not nearly as toxic as NH3. So the dropping pH that's happening anytime you've got a fish breathing in a bag, that dropping pH is acting to mitigate the toxicity of the ammonia. And so when you open up that bag or pour it into a bucket and you start dripping water from the tank into that bag where there's a lot of NH4+, you have higher pH, higher alkalinity water going into the bag, and that's going to immediately raise the pH in the bag and turn that ammonia into its toxic NH3 form.
Wow.
And so you're creating a tremendous, they're getting ammonia burns, even if they're just in there for an hour exposed to that very high toxic form of ammonia can kill the fish on the spot, or at very least do so much damage to their gills that they're going to die over the next few days. So I don't know exactly what our instructions say on the website, but I'll tell you what I do whenever I get a new fish that's been in a bag overnight. I float the bag in the tank until the temperature is the same. And then I open the bag and I take my hand in there and very gently pick up the fish and put it right into the tank.
Really?
Right. We know change isn't good. Saltwater fish especially don't like any kind of change, whether that change is pH or alkalinity or temperature or salinity, right? But if you can just reduce the number of different things that are changing rapidly at once, then you can go a long way. And temperature is a big one, especially if you're going from lower to higher temperature. So even if they're getting exposed to a sudden change in pH and a sudden change in ammonia and a sudden change in all these other things, the temperature is exactly the same. At least there's that one stress removed from the equation. And you know, most of the fish that we keep, even though lots of them are found out on coral reefs, a lot of them live in coastal areas that are subject to changes in salinity. And as long as none of the salinity involved in the bag or the new tank is way off the mark, a change in a few parts per thousand of a few parts per thousand in salinity is not really all that stressful if the temperature is the same. So I believe in temperature acclimation and then a careful.
Wow. So 30 minutes in terms of acclimating to temperature, is that about right or less, more?
That sounds about right, but it depends on how much water is in the bag, right? If you got a gallon of water in that bag, it might take more than 30 minutes to get to be the same temperature as the tank. And if it's 2 ounces of water, it might only take 10 minutes.
So temperature acclimate, and the fish goes right into whatever tank or system its home is going to be.
That is what I do.
Wow. You learn something new every day, I'll tell you. That is something I've been doing drip acclimating. I've been doing this for a long time, and that's kind of like the way I'm a coral guy. I'm more of a coral guy than a fish person for sure. But
and maybe with corals, it makes more sense. I don't know. But and I'm not saying it's always the wrong thing to do. Right. If you catch a fish in the bay at your house and you bring it home 10 minutes later, and there's no ammonia built up in there yet, but the salinity in the bay was 20 parts per thousand and the salinity in your tank is 35 parts per thousand, I think that's a good candidate for a drip acclimation. That's how you avoid a sudden salinity shock. But you're not, you know, we're all pretty much on the same page with our salinity. We're not keeping our tanks at vastly different salinities unless we're really being negligent on topping off, right? So a difference in just a few parts per thousand of salinity, I think, is pretty tolerable to most fish.
All right, the last question of the night is going to come from John Wright, and I think it's a good, really good question. Would Tom put the new fish in an acclimation box first? Should all fish going into a display tank go into an acclimation box?
I think they make great sense. And it's not something I use because I don't really keep display tanks. But I think it's a really good idea. And, you know, I really tuned into this while working at the aquarium, and this was just looking at the shark. We take a new fish. I remember we raised a baby mahi-mahi one time.
Cool.
So beautiful. So awesome. We raised it up to about 2 feet
wow.
long. And
that's awesome.
And it was the only place it could go was into the shark tank. And we put it into the shark tank. And every fish in the tank could just sense that this was the new guy. And part of it was the stress, the stress hormones they release from being picked up and moved and handled and netted, And I mean, that fish was eaten within about 30 seconds of going into the tank. And I see this very often. So any new fish, even if you don't see damage on it, it has been handled and moved. And it's got abrasions, its slime coat isn't fully intact. And the other fish pick up on that. They pick up on this. It's just like, you know, the new kid in a third grade classroom. Everyone knows he's new and nervous and scared, and they pick on him and they tune into that. And so an acclimation box will allow the fish to get his, you know, slime coat back and get the other fish accustomed to the smell and the sight of him. And, you know, that sudden fascination that they have with a brand new fish put into the tank. Let's all, you know, even if they're just trying to be nice and not bite his fins off, he's going to get all the attention, and it's going to be very stressful. So a period of time where they can't harass him, I think, or bring him a casserole for, you know, being newly moved in is going to really help ease the transition.
What would you say is a good amount of time in an acclimation box? A week?
I don't know. That sounds good. I think they're a great idea. I don't have a call for them in my current life, but I think, you know, a week sounds good. But I think it's a case by case thing, even whether it's needed, I think is a case by case thing, but I think it's a good idea in a tank where you have lots of established fish already.
Matt B says, my father has never drip acclimated. He has far more success with the new inhabitants than me. I stopped doing it and only temp acclimated. I have found far more success. There you go. For not doing drip acclimation. Well, Todd, man, listen, I really appreciate you taking the time and sharing your knowledge. I certainly learned a lot, and I'm sure everybody that tuned in did as well. So appreciate you, man.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you very much.
So thanks again to Todd. I also want to thank the sponsors one more time, Champion Lighting and Supply. Besides being a place for hobbyists to purchase saltwater aquarium supplies online, Champion Lighting is also a wholesale distributor for many popular brands. If you own an aquarium store or an aquarium service company, contact Champion Lighting through the website at championlighting.com to set up a wholesale account. Polo Reef, make sure to check out Polo Reef's new YouTube video that drops tomorrow. In the Polo University episode, Andrew and Dr. Alex Howe look at Uronema, black ick, and flukes in detail. Also look for their Friday video this week, a podcast with Bob Stark from ESV with some very interesting topics. Make sure to subscribe to their YouTube channel at Polo Reef for video drop notifications. And finally, Fauna Marine. I do use the Fauna Marine Reef's ICP Total Test Kit, which gives a quick, accurate, and easy overview of over 90 water values in reef aquariums. From macro elements to trace elements and pollutants, you get a complete overview with corresponding dosage and action recommendations. Big thank you to Paul, who's also the moderator, as well as the president of the Boston Reefer Society. Please join and support your local reefing clubs. They are so important to this hobby. I want to let you know that all episodes of Rapid Reef Bum are also available as podcasts on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and Amazon. My next Rapping with Reef Bum live stream will be next Tuesday, May 14th, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. My guest will be Jim Graham, a.k.a. Telegram. If you want to check out the full upcoming schedule of guests, visit reefbum.com under the YouTube section. Until next time, be safe and be well. Later.